All right, Alexander, let's talk about the situation in Afghanistan, the Taliban specific, and Mark Milley, who came out with some comments the other day. And he said that, you know what, there is a possibility that the U.S. military could now be coordinating with the Taliban in order to take out the Special K. Everyone knows what I mean when I use the word the Special K, the new variant of the IS. And the Taliban responded to Milley's proposal. It did seem like a proposal. I mean, he was saying, you know, we're going to coordinate with the Taliban to take out the Special K. And the Taliban said, no thanks. They said, well, we'll handle. Yeah, yes, we'll handle the Special K on our own. We really don't need the United States. I mean, in essence, Alexander, they rebuked the U.S. military. What does that tell you? How about that?
Well, I mean, does it surprise you? After all, the Taliban have won a war where they were opposed by the US military. That war has only just ended. So why would they be looking for help from the US at this time? I'm absolutely sure that the Taliban will be able to deal with a Special K, as you put it. And though I have no information about this, I'm pretty sure that the Taliban will see this offer from Milley as an attempt by the US to insert itself back into Afghanistan from whence it's just been driven out. And I would not be at all surprised if there's some people within the Taliban who think that the whole reason why there is a problem with Special K at the moment is precisely because the United States wants to insert itself back into Afghanistan by offering military aid in this fashion. I think the Taliban have decided that they want to keep the US as far away from Afghanistan as possible. And of course, they're snubbing the US. But, you know, let's look at it from the other side. I don't think it's difficult to understand the Taliban's reasoning. But how humiliating is it that the United States, which has fought long wars against the Taliban, it's been fighting the Taliban for 20 years, it sort of ousted from power in 2001 and for a brief time successfully did so, has always said that the Taliban were protecting various jihadi terrorist groups, is now saying that he wants to work with the Taliban to fight jihadi terrorist groups. It's the United States going complete full circle, saying, you know, that the Taliban aren't really our enemy, they're potentially our ally, and reversing in effect all that they've been saying and doing for the last 20 years. And I have to say, I mean, it makes me my mind spin when I look at the way in which US policy changes from one day to the next. But bear in mind that they're doing this, that making these offers at the same time that they refuse to recognize the Taliban's government and have frozen Afghanistan's financial reserves. So, I mean, you know, it's bizarre, it's weird. And as I said, it does make one wonder what the United States was doing fighting the Taliban for 20 years, if it now says that, you know, actually they want to work with the Taliban after all.
You know, you mentioned that the U.S. government has frozen their reserves and they've taken certain economic actions against the Taliban. At the same time, though, you get statements from people like Jake Sullivan and Blinken saying that they would welcome the opportunity to fund the Taliban on certain social issues. What does that tell you? I mean, it seems very weird that on the one hand you have apparently, these are sanctions in some sort of a form against against Afghanistan and the Taliban government. On the other side, you have other people in the White House who are saying, you know what, we're going to continue aid to the Taliban, we're going to continue funding various institutions as long as the Taliban or this new Afghan government follows rule of law and, you know, blah blah blah, the same old tropes that they always throw out there. What mixed messages, isn't it?
Well, it's complete mixed messages, but I'm pretty sure that the people who are giving the messages are one and the same people. I don't think this is a case of part of the administration in conflict with another part. I think it's very simple. I think, first of all, obviously, there is, as we've discussed many times, deep dysfunction within the US government. But this is also, to my mind, a reflection of the essentially adolescent quality of decision-making in Washington at the time. Because I suspect what's happening is that Jake Sullivan and people like him are saying to themselves, well, how do we get influence back over the situation? Well, on the one hand, we freeze the reserves, put the Taliban in a very difficult economic position because we create a tremendous economic squeeze for them. And at the same time, we try to win them over by offering them money. I think this is the way, the mindset of the people in Washington. But of course, I don't think the Taliban are frankly going to be impressed by any of that, because on the one hand, they've just defeated the United States, so it doesn't make any sense for them to cooperate with the United States now. But besides, I think that the Taliban are now looking beyond the United States for help from other powers, from Russia, from China, from Pakistan, from Saudi Arabia, from those sort of places. And if you're looking at the countries in aggregate, well, I mean, $7 billion is loose change. And it's only loose change compared to what the US has spent in Afghanistan up to now. So it's the kind of strategy that I think is only going to increase Taliban contempt for the US rather than win any kind of US influence in the US. But it's the kind of attitude, the kind of policy that a Rhodes Scholar, a great intellectual like Jake Sullivan might come up with. He thinks that he's, you know, wielding a carrot and a stick, but he doesn't understand that the Taliban are not interested in either.
All right, so, you know, Afghanistan has freaked everyone out in the international community, specifically the allies of the United States. And, of course, these mixed messages, I'm sure, are not helping things repair with all the damage that has been done. And this brings me to the European Union and how they're capitalizing, the EU hawks, how they're capitalizing on what has happened in Afghanistan by pushing now for this EU army. We had a statement from Josep Borrell, who is in effect the foreign minister of the EU. That's not his exact title, but that's what he is, the foreign minister for the European Union. And he said that it's clear, and this is a quote, "It's clear that the need for more European defense has never been as much as evident as today after the events in Afghanistan. There are events that catalyze the history. Sometimes something happens that pushes the history. It creates a breakthrough. And I think that that the Afghanistan events of this summer are one of these cases, a breakthrough." And he's referencing the building of an EU army. This is, of course, you have NATO. But this is an incredible statement from Borrell. And as I said, the EU hawks seem to have found something they can grab onto to really push hard for the creation of an EU army. And looking at the United States, the mixed messages from the Biden administration, the debacle in Afghanistan with the evacuation, they may have the opportunity to actually push through an EU army.
Well, let's first of all talk about that. Let's just say something, a few things, because we're also hearing the same voices, the same siren voices, I'm going to call siren voices, in Britain. You're now seeing all kinds of commentators and political leaders who are coming along and say, well, Britain can no longer rely on the United States. The debacle in the United States proves that in Afghanistan proves that the United States is no longer reliable. Our Defense Secretary Ben Wallace has actually given an interview to the Spectator magazine in which he's actually said that the United States is no longer a superpower. And how do we apparently or supposedly guarantee our security? We do so by joining up with our European allies and, of course, step by step, joining up with this European ally. In other words, we leave the EU in one form and we go back into it in another form, this time through the vehicle of defence cooperation and ultimately a European army. Now, let's just unpack all of this. First of all, if there'd been a European army, it would have made absolutely no difference to the outcome in Afghanistan, because where the US military, which is much better organized than any conceivable European army might be, could not prevail there. And a European army in Afghanistan would have been undoubtedly a great deal less effective than the United States military would have been. So, I mean, this connection, this attempt by people like Borrell to use the situation in Afghanistan to justify creating a European army is on its face nonsense. But that's not what these people are really about. They're not about Afghanistan at all. They're ultimately even about, you know, defence, European defence. They are about their vision of transforming the European Union into a European superstate. So they wanted to have a government. They wanted to have its own currency, which of course it has, its own central bank, its own military, and its own military system, which is of course part of the trappings of a state, so that of course the militaries of the member states are ultimately subsumed into this big European military, and those states lose even more of their sovereignty than they have already. That is ultimately what it's about. It's not about projecting European power abroad. It's not even about, you know, increasing European defence at the moment, because, to be straightforward about it, who really is threatening Europe? I mean, you know, where does this great military threat come from? It is about accelerating the development of the European superstate, eventually doing away with NATO, because straightforwardly, NATO and a European army would be inconsistent with each other, and establishing Europe as a kind of new European superstate that would presumably give more jobs to people like Josep Borrell. He'd be able to call himself a foreign minister instead of simply a high representative, which is what ultimately this is all about. So that's the agenda that these people are pursuing. And they're just using events like the ones in Afghanistan in order to promote it. Because, as I said, this is no bearing on what actually happened there.
I mean, the US is NATO. It accounts for something like 75% of the NATO budget. What is an EU army without the US? I'm just trying to square the circle here, try to understand the logic behind this. An EU army without the US and the EU saying, we don't want NATO. And then the U.S. saying, well, OK, well, we are NATO. I mean, what are you guys talking about? It's like saying we don't want the U.S. Help me understand this.
Well, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what they're saying. I mean, an EU army without the U.S., a European army without the U.S., it's not just a ghost. It's a joke. The idea that it's any kind of military force is almost comical. I mean, there is no conceivable way that any kind of European military structure could be created in any, you know, foreseeable future without the US. And of course, the US is involved in Europe, and it's involved in Europe through NATO. Now, the only way you could create a European army that could substitute theoretically for the US is, of course, if you provided it with enormous funds. And that would mean increasing taxation across the European Union, and that would have to be your centralised taxation administered from Brussels. So you begin to see what the kind of agenda is, because, of course, that means you'd have to set up a European tax system in order to fund this army, and that system would have to go deep into the states, take money from the citizens in order to fund the army, and that would create even more of an institutional structure in the EU than exists now. So that's partly what the agenda of having a European army is. It's a building block towards further developing the EU. But the reality is, even if they did that, it would still not substitute or replace the US. The US, as you rightly says, accounts for 75% or something like that of NATO defence spending. Its military spans the world. I mean, obviously, there have been many criticisms of it, but it's got capabilities that no European state or collection of European states could ever remotely hope to match in any foreseeable future. And of course, a European army brought together higgledy-piggledy, you know, with people from Germany serving alongside those from France and Italy and Croatia and Poland and whatever. It would lack the kind of coherence that the US military, which is the military of a real country, actually has. I mean, would those soldiers serving in that European army feel the same kind of commitment to that army as American soldiers feel to the US military? Well, the answer is of course not. So it's a phantom. It's nonsense. But as I said, Borrell isn't really interested in the army as such. What he wants to do is two things. He wants to, on the one hand, build up the superstate. And as I said, the European army would be a building block to that. And of course, ultimately, he does want to see the back of the United States. There's, I should say, a very strong tradition within European politics. You do come across it from time to time among some European politicians, which regards the Second World War as a European civil war, which outsiders, the Americans and the Russians, took advantage of or were able to come in and establish themselves in Europe as a result of it. And their vision is to try to drive out these outsiders, the Americans and the Russians, and establish the United Europe, which, to be straightforward about it, some of them were trying to build in the 1940s, after the German victories against France. So that's, in a way, a reversion to those sort of policies. Clearly, this is an anti-American policy. It's ultimately also an anti-Russian policy because the European army would be directed at the Russians. It's very much a policy to integrate the European Union and to create a European state, but of course, a military superpower it wouldn't create, not in a month of Sundays. It could never happen. As I said, what would be built would be another Frankenstein's monster, another ghost, something that has no reality, but which would be an enormous burden on the people of Europe.
Yeah, definitely fallout from Afghanistan, though. Definitely important fallout from collateral damage to the United States when you have the Europeans saying, you know what, we would prefer to build an EU army rather than stick with NATO. That's what can you say there?
But you see, the other thing to say is it's also a reflection of the policies of the Biden-Harris administration. Now, Trump, despite everything that people say, didn't want to weaken NATO. He actually strengthened NATO. He wanted the European states to contribute more to NATO. In other words, to put aside any fantasies about a European army and become more involved in developing NATO. Whereas the Biden-Harris administration is talking in a completely different language. They're talking about retreat, or rather a scaling down of the US commitment to Europe so that the United States can face off China and do other things around the world. So this American retreat from Europe is what the Europeans, some Europeans, are now working with as they press ahead with their vision of a European superstate. And of course, events like Afghanistan play into their narrative. As I said before, these people may be the most terrible managers. They may be mediocre at everything, but at keeping their project going and going forward, well, they are past masters, and at using every little opportunity to keep it the ball rolling ever forward, well, that's also very much what they're about.
All right. We will leave it there. TheDuran.locals.com. Everybody, you'll find the link down below. 10% off. Use the code REALNEWS for the Duran shop. That link is also down below. Take care.